kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
It is Friday, January the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, lawmakers questioning intelligence chiefs about alleged Russian hacking of U.S. computers during the presidential election.
Would you just want to hack the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign, or do you want maximum leverage? I think most intelligence officials would say if you're the Russians, you're at least going to make an attempt to get all the information you can from everybody.
What challenges might the U.S. president-elect face when he takes office? The fate of an Israeli soldier who killed a Palestinian man, plus the upcoming Golden Globe Awards. Hello, everyone. Good to have you with us again. Top U.S. intelligence officials say they believe high-level Russian authorities were directly responsible for hacking and leaking of documents from the U.S. National Democratic Party in an effort to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper was among the officials making remarks before lawmakers who sit on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
This was a multifaceted campaign, so the hacking was only one part of it, and it also entailed classical propaganda, disinformation, fake news.
While the intelligence chiefs agreed that Russia was involved in hacking the DNC documents, Clapper noted that the intelligence community can't gauge any effect the information released by WikiLeaks might have had on citizens' choices on who they were voting for president. President Obama has ordered the intelligence community to review potential foreign interference dating back to 2008. That's the election that brought him to the White House. International Edition's Sarah Williams discussed the issue with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden.
What is the actual data? And right now, what the U.S. intelligence community has said is that they've looked at the activities, they looked at what happened, how the information was used, and they say the evidence is there. And as a result of the evidence, they've made the assessment that these activities only could have been directed by the highest level of the Russian government, essentially pointing a finger at Vladimir Putin. But whenever they've been questioned about what the actual evidence is, there was one point where a senator was asking, well, Russians are usually pretty good at covering their tracks. What happened here? They've deferred. They said that there's the comprehensive report that they've been asked to do by President Obama is going to be coming out. They're going to unclassify parts of that report and release it next week. But in an open setting, in an unclassified setting, they've said they're just not prepared to discuss those details because it gets to sources and methods. And traditionally, they try to not talk about that stuff because they don't want adversaries to know how they're getting information. So there's still a lot of question about what the evidence is, but one thing that Director of National Intelligence James Clapper did say is that he stands more resolutely behind that assessment, that it was directed by the top levels of the Russian government. He stands more sure of that today than he was back when the intelligence community, in an unprecedented move, announced back in October that they thought the hacks were the result of the Russian government.
Is it known the extent of the hacking?
That's also a good question. There was a question that came up during the hearing about what the extent was, whether it was just the DNC, whether it was just John Podesta, who was helping run Hillary Clinton's campaign. And again, they didn't want to answer that in an open setting. If you take a step back and say, well, if you're the Russians, what do you want to do? Would you just want to hack the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign, or do you want maximum leverage? I think most intelligence officials would say if you're the Russians, you're at least going to make an attempt to get all the information you can from everybody. And in Russia for a while has been carrying out these types of activities, both in the United States and in other countries in Europe, hacking and probing and trying to collect information. What many current and former intelligence officials have said, what makes this case different, this incident with the U.S. 2016 election different, is that it seems in some of their assessments that Russia actually tries to weaponize the information. They try to selectively leak material, put out fake news and other propaganda to mess with the results, whether they wanted President-elect Trump to actually win or whether they wanted some other results. They say that seems to be a departure. There are those in the greater intelligence community, former intelligence officials, who question that, who say that doesn't comport exactly with what they've seen the Russians do before in terms of how they use information. So there are still a lot of questions. And one thing that the hearing is not likely to clear up is or do is create any certainty or change any behavior, perhaps, or any of the public statements by President-elect Trump, who says, look, there are reasons to question these assessments.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a divide between the U.S. intelligence community and President-elect Trump.
And that's something that's been growing concern. The other day I was speaking to a U.S. official who said that there's just the alarm is spreading and growing about the dynamic that's developing between President-elect Trump and the intelligence community. And I found it to be an interesting comment because, as I've spoken to people before, generally they always say, look, we have a mission in the U.S. intelligence community. We're committed to that mission, and that mission is for the good of the United States. It doesn't depend on who the president is. So for them to start saying that more and more publicly, it does raise some concern. And there have been questions in the hearing about who benefits from this continued questioning of the U.S. intelligence community and the job that it's doing. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said, look, there's always a need for healthy skepticism, that the intelligence community is made up of people who do the best they can, but they are people. But, you know, some of the lawmakers said, look, isn't it Iran, North Korea, China, other potential or current U.S. adversaries that benefit from this atmosphere that creates a general mistrust of the U.S. intelligence community?
That is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Since Russia's 2014 forceful takeover of Crimea, both Moscow and NATO have deployed troops, as well as weapons along old fault lines, as tensions have grown to their highest since the end of the Cold War. Analysts are saying the dangers of a military confrontation are at their highest for decades. The upcoming change of administration here in Washington will likely have a major impact on relations between NATO and the Kremlin, although Henry Ridgewell reports analysts say there is huge uncertainty over how the new era of East-West tensions will play out in 2017.
Nuclear-capable Iskander missiles deployed by Moscow in October last year to Kaliningrad, which borders NATO members Poland and Lithuania. Russia has also carried out a series of military exercises along its western frontiers. NATO has put 300,000 troops on high alert and has also made so-called tripwire deployments in frontline states. There is a growing danger of accidental escalation, warns NATO's former information officer in Moscow, John Luff, now at Chatham House.
It seems to me that it's actually very important to have mechanisms in place that allow the military establishments to communicate when needed, because both sides should see that there is, in fact, the capacity here for some sort of accident.
NATO is deploying an extra 4,000 multinational troops to the Baltic states and Poland in the coming months. The core NATO principle of collective defence is being revitalised, says Luff.
NATO is starting, if you like, from a low base in terms of rebuilding this defensive capability. It's not the sort of thing that happens overnight. But I would argue that the evidence of political will here, in fact, is probably more important.
But Donald Trump's victory in the U.S. election has triggered uncertainty over the future U.S. commitment to NATO's primary force. The U.S. spent $66 billion on defense in 2016. Second-placed Britain spent less than a tenth of that figure. President-elect Trump has questioned the United States' financial burden, and analysts say Moscow is watching with interest.
Collective defence has actually, I think, psychologically at least, been a huge deterrent for Russia. Trump may change that calculation if he certainly pledges not to necessarily come to, NATO allies' help in a situation of need if they haven't paid their 2% defence spending.
President-elect Trump's praise for Russian leader Vladimir Putin has rattled Ukraine, which is battling pro-Kremlin rebels in the east.
That will allow or embolden Russia to maybe test the boundaries of NATO and test the unity of NATO even further, I think.
It is premature to assume that Donald Trump's early overtures to Moscow will translate into a lasting détente, argues Luff.
There are going to be areas where they disagree, and perception of Iran, for example, is one of them, and I think that will come to the fore quickly.
Rearmament on both sides has raised the stakes. The new US administration will likely herald more uncertainty in an increasingly tense environment. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We'll have more on how the Trump administration might deal with international issues straight ahead on International Edition. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. VOA. Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. As we noted earlier, Donald Trump is about to become the next U.S. president, and when he assumes office in 2 weeks, his attention will be split between domestic and international policies. VOA's Steve Miller speaks with East West Institute's Jonathan Miller on challenges the new administration might face.
In about 2 weeks, Donald Trump will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. He faces a wide range of domestic issues, several of which were key in securing the support of swing states during the election. However, the United States is not alone in the world, and in the short time since the election, President-elect Trump has already ventured into diplomatic waters through his tweets. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may be the first to present a challenge to a newly inaugurated President Trump after signaling his country would conduct an intercontinental ballistic missile test. It's a weapon, when perfected, that could reach the continental United States. Speaking on Skype, the East-West Institute's Jonathan Miller says while many carefully analyze the nuances of President Obama's messages, Mr. Trump's tweets should be viewed with broader strokes.
My biggest concern with regard to the Trump administration's policy on North Korea is that it needs to maintain a solidarity with its allies, Japan and South Korea. So there's a concern, as you mentioned, that Trump might just go it alone and look for bilateral negotiations. That's exactly what the North is looking for.
Trump taking a call from Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen will also present some diplomatic challenges, since he's publicly questioned the long-standing tradition of honoring the One China policy.
But I also think in the South China Sea, it's going to continue to be an area where the U.S. loses leverage. We even saw that at the final days of the Obama administration. So I think that China is going to continue to press hard in the South China Sea.
Moving forward, Miller says it's important to focus on the interactions the incoming president has with other nations.
Trump appears, anyways, to be focusing things in a very transactional manner, in a very bilateral manner. So it looks like he might engage with allies and partners from a bilateral perspective. We definitely see that from a trade realm. But we potentially could see this from a security perspective, too.
Like if the Trump administration will put as much emphasis on multilateral organizations like ASEAN or trilateral meetings, such as the U.S.-Japan-South Korea summits, as the Obama administration did. How President Trump proceeds in that area towards Asia is one factor, Miller says, to watch. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is among those calling for a pardon for a young Israeli soldier who was convicted this week by a military court in Tel Aviv of manslaughter in the shooting death in March of a Palestinian as he lay wounded on the ground. 20-year-old, that is, Sergeant Elzor Azaria, faces up to 20 years in prison. The families of the soldier and the lawyers condemn the verdict. Hundreds of protesters have demanded his release, and the father of the Palestinian killed in Hebron in the West Bank has called the verdict fair. Regional scholar Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina here in the U.S. tells VOA's Victor Beatty the shooting occurred during a time of tension when hundreds of Palestinian attacks against Israelis were being carried out.
Part of the defense of the soldier was about the overall atmosphere surrounding the case, whereas the military authorities, when they decided to put him to trial, looked at the situation only from the perspective of him disobeying the standing orders of the army and doing something that should not have been done. He was found guilty, and so far as I'm concerned, the decision has to be respected.
A poll suggests that two-thirds of the public surveyed want him released.
You have to bear in mind that there is a very strong sense that in a situation like the one that existed at the time, the usual or the normal procedures with regard to terrorists sometimes were not clear. The overall atmosphere was one of nervousness and fear. And there is also, of course, the sense of many people in Israel that as a soldier, he needs to be defended by the military rather than be prosecuted by them. After the punishment, it will be a political issue. I suspect that there will not be a pardon. Never mind what people say, but that remains to be seen.
The 50th anniversary of Israel's capture of the West Bank is approaching. This trial has generated some debate about whether the military is out of touch with a public that is shifting to the right in its attitudes toward the Palestinians.
And part of it is because of the overall anti-Israel and anti-Semitic atmosphere that exists in large parts of the world, in Europe and even in the U.S. to an extent. And that, of course, elicits counter-reaction in Israel as one can expect it to be. The military is doing a great job. That's a great military. We would like to think it's the best military in the world. I don't think that the military can be judged in terms of being either left or right. They are a political organization, and so they should be. But it's true, as you suggested, Victor, that a great deal of the Israeli public is definitely shifting to the right. There's no question about it.
The killing of 21-year-old Palestinian Abdul Fattah al-Sharif was caught on video. It went viral worldwide. Israeli military has been criticized for using excessive force in quelling the Palestinian unrest. Scientists have been creating antibiotics to kill deadly bacteria for nearly 80 years now. Unfortunately, the bacteria that causes disease can't adapt so quickly that they've evolved into superbugs that are basically resistant to all antibiotics. That's why scientists at the University of Colorado's BioFrontiers Institute, looking in beyond biologically based medicines, they're developing an antibiotic that can be updated even with the click of a keyboard. From Boulder, Colorado, Shelley Schlender reports on what's called quantum dot antibiotics.
So these are plates with these highly...
These petri dishes hold some of the world's most dangerous microbes. That's because they harbor disease-causing superbugs. University of Colorado scientist Anushree Cherraji says they're hard to stop with traditional drugs.
They're resistant to, in some cases, more than 20 different antibiotics. And they can actually live in pretty high levels of antibiotics. Not only can they survive, but they can actually thrive in presence of antibiotics.
It takes years to develop traditional, biologically-based antibiotics. Cherraji's husband and colleague, Prashant Nagpal, says we're losing the race against superbugs. But he has an idea.
Let's develop a system that can adapt, if not faster, at least at the same rate as the microbes do.
To reach this goal, Nagpal's lab analyzes the DNA of superbugs, then creates a highly targeted antibiotic, not in years, but in just a few days. He does this by using machines that make the antibiotic from tiny semiconductor particles known as quantum dots.
semiconductors, we always think, oh, it's going to end up in a camera on top of our rooftops. You could use the same semiconductors, shrink them down, and put them inside cells.
Each dot is 20,000 times smaller than a living cell. Nagpal's research team mixes millions into tubes and fine-tunes their properties. Ultraviolet light reveals different varieties. For stopping a superbug, Nagpal says one tiny tube packs a mighty punch.
I mean, this could easily be the entire therapy that you need.
Once activated, Nagpal says the dots send out atom-sized free radicals specifically designed to damage the superbug they've been programmed to kill. The dots make these minuscule missiles from something simple.
They just use oxygen and water, and they create these radical species that specifically harm these microbes. But these species are not harmful for mammalian cells, our host, our human cells.
The researchers have used the dots on roundworms that usually succumb to superbugs. Cherji says the dots killed the deadly microbes without any harm to the worms.
This particular method can actually eliminate a large fraction of these very highly resistant clinical isolates. Yes.
Cherji and Nagpal say that years of testing lie ahead before assuring these quantum dots are safe for human use. But their results so far make them hopeful that someday their tiny semiconductor particles will help doctors keep up with superbugs.
Yeah, we use that
for VOA News, really well, I'm Shelley Schlender in Boulder, Colorado.
And in Washington, I'm Steve Norman.
This is BizBeat.
Another taxi service idea enters the market, this one coming from Sweden. It's a three-wheeled pod taxi that uses electric power, seating two people and the driver. Sven Wolf is the CEO of BZZT.
These vehicles are doing the best job on short trips, and that's also where we see the strength of what we offer.
Wolf sees worldwide potential for his idea and says the pod taxi complements city mobility with other types of transportation like biking, walking, buses, and subways. And like Uber, you hail the pod on your app, but it's environmentally friendly. Frida Long now is a student who likes the convenience of the bright yellow pod taxi.
It's cheap, and it's easy to get by in the city of Gothenburg in a quick way.
The pods go 75 kilometers on a single charge. The company plans a 20-pod trial service in Stockholm this year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. The 74th Golden Globes Awards show is this Sunday. It will be happening in Los Angeles, California. And as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Tonight Show host, Jimmy Fallon from U.S. Television, will host the show, which honors the best in movies, television, and music.
Two, three.
Jimmy Fallon rolled out the red carpet for the Golden Globes and said he's excited to host the show because it honors so many different parts of the entertainment industry.
This show is different than the Oscars or the Grammys, where it's kind of a mixtape of a show where it's the best in movies, the best in TV. So if you haven't seen the movie, you go like, I never saw that. I don't even want to see that. And I go, you don't have to worry about it because this will be somebody from The Walking Dead going on stage in about 2 seconds.
The awards are presented by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and its 85 members have no say in nominations or voting for the Oscars. Fallon says he's not nervous about hosting the show from the Beverly Hilton Hotel.
No, doing the Tonight Show kind of is an advantage because I actually watch all these movies and all these TV shows as part of my actual normal job. So I know all the people nominated. So it's going to be fun. I don't know how they are as an audience. I hope they're good. I know how they are as guests. They're great. But it's like, who knows? They better be clapping and laughing or else they're going to hear from me when they come on my show.
Unlike the Oscars, where everyone is seated in a large theater, the Golden Globes have nominees and presenters seated at tables and eating dinner. This year, the stars will dine on sea bass and filet mignon and a choice of three different desserts. Beverly Hilton executive chef Alberico Nunziata says he will feed the stars as if they had come to his home.
This is the first year that an Italian is cooking for the Golden Globes. This is the first year that an Italian is the executive chef of the Beverly Hilton. And I was like really celebrating this. The idea on the back is like what we do in Italy the best. We host, I'm inviting all the celebrities at my house. And I was making something like I will make for dinner at my house if they're coming. And this was the idea on the back in reality.
And the stars will have plenty to choose from on the dessert table. Beverly Hilton executive pastry chef Thomas Henze says many times the stars do indulge, even if it means more time in the gym the next day.
They actually, I'm surprised they do, and especially that's why we like to keep the portions small. And there'll be some plates that come back clean, which is very nice to see.
Barry Adelman is the executive vice president of television for Dick Clark Productions. He says that audiences can expect some mention of the recent election, but he hopes that everyone has a good time.
Look, I think that's up to the audiences. Obviously, it was a hard-fought election, and some people were happy, some people weren't. But the Golden Globes has always been an opportunity, no matter what the year has been like, to kind of kick back and just have fun for one night, and we hope everybody does.
The 74th Golden Globe Awards air Sunday. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm told it's very popular abroad as well, not just in the United States. You know, Dave was mentioning a couple of things that were interesting, just something I'd like to add. I've read many times that the Golden Globes are, according to the artists and producers and people like that, more honest, they say, awards than some other award shows, such as the Grammys or the Academy Awards or the Emmys. Well, I don't know how true that is, but anyway, Golden Globes coming up here fairly soon. I want to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison, for a great night. Good to have you with us. It is night here in the U.S., day wherever you are. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great one.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the recent signing of a political compromise agreement by the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, and opposition party leaders. By paving the way for peaceful democratic elections in 2017, this agreement marks an important and historic step for the DRC and the region of Central Africa. The United States commends the willingness of President Joseph Kabila and opposition leaders to compromise on key issues, thereby laying the groundwork for the country's first democratic transfer of power. Under the Constitution, President Kabila should have left office on December 20th, at the end of his second and final mandate. A crisis ensued when he failed to organize elections and stepped down. Under the terms of the deal, President Kabila agreed not to seek a third term or change the Constitution, but will remain in office until the installation of his successor, following elections which will be held by the end of December 2017. An oversight council responsible for overseeing implementation of the agreement will be established and headed by opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi, and a prime minister will be named from among the opposition Rassemblement coalition. The United States also commends the tireless mediating role played by the DRC's Conference of Catholic Bishops, leading to this agreement. Blessed with natural resources but burdened with corruption and political instability, the Democratic Republic of Congo has never witnessed a democratic transfer of power since it gained independence from Belgium in 1960. 2 decades ago, the country fought some of the deadliest conflicts in modern African history. Wars in the late 1990s and early 2000s dragged in forces from at least six African countries and left more than 3 million dead. The east of the country remains a battleground for armed conflict between rival militias. This political agreement provides an opportunity to take the DRC in a new and peaceful direction. The United States, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner, encourages the DRC government and opposition leaders to continue their cooperation as they work to implement this agreement and preserve the progress achieved on behalf of the Congolese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.